Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is In the Loop. It's our first show of the new year. I don't know why, but I guess I expected things might be different somehow. But the country feels a little bit like it's on hold, at least until January 20th, maybe beyond. In keeping with that vibe, just a lot of delaying of things going on this week. Looks like Obama's big stimulus package, for example, might not get the fast-track treatment he'd been hoping for. Obama's team is suggesting we put off the February shift to HDTV around the country because the government has run out of coupon money. Two Senate seats, of course, here in Minnesota, and Roland Burris, a rain-soaked potential senator from Illinois. Those seats are still sitting on hold. In the midst of all of this delay and postponement, at least one guy is done stalling. Larry Craig, who ended his appeals this week. And that may very well be my last Larry Craig joke. It's been a good ride. Last week was looking bright, but the stock markets clearly decided to delay their recovery for now. Looks like the S&P was down, about 4% for the week. But into this darkness, I bring you now a ray of sunshine. In a year when most of us in the U.S. stock market lost more than a third of our money, one U.S. mutual fund actually made money in 2008. Not a lot, 0.4% for the year. But to most investors right about now, that sounds like winning the lottery. Tom Forrester manages the Forrester Value Fund from his base in Chicago. Tom, first I should say, I guess, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much.
You lucky son of a whatever. Really, what are the reactions that you're getting from so many of your colleagues that just had this disastrous 2008?
You know, most of them are real positive. You know, I've got a lot of friends in the business and have gotten congratulations from kind of across the country. So, you know, it was difficult, but, you know, we were fortunate in the last hour of the market, we pulled it out.
Important to point out, because I think a lot of people would wonder, your fund, Forrester Value Fund, no funny business, no tricky financial somersaults, right? Basically, you buy and sell stocks.
Yeah, I mean, we might also use some cash in our fund. But, you know, largely it's just a U.S. large-cap value fund.
Statistically, you could argue that of all the mutual funds in the country, somebody had to get lucky, right? Was there a lot of luck involved?
You know, there's always luck involved. I think that we went into the year with a good thesis, and it really proved out throughout the year and helped us in determining what sectors to be in and what stocks to be in.
Real estate, the financial sector, all these things that were so devastating to so many people who were invested in those parts of the market and the rest of the market that was attached to them. How did you not get dragged down by all that?
In 2004, the housing price to income started rising above where it had the range that it had traditionally been in. By 2005, you were in bubble territory. And by 2006, it was getting kind of ridiculous. If you knew that housing prices were coming down, you also knew that mortgage-related securities were going to get hit pretty hard. Then you also knew that those companies that held the mortgage-related securities were going to get hit hard.
So you got out of financial stocks, banks, and other things like that you thought might be tied up in that.
Largely, yeah.
Well, lots of people were talking about that, and in hindsight, it seems so obvious. This is just a matter of guts, isn't it, to make that decision at the time?
It is. I mean, it's a pretty extreme move, actually. I mean, you have to really have the courage of your conviction to go for something like that.
So if you were getting wisely out of a number of things in 2008, what were you getting into?
Pharmaceuticals, consumer staples area, things that, you know, people buy year in, year out, whether you're in a recession or not. We owned Anheuser-Busch, which got taken over at a very nice price.
Oh, not because people were drinking beer so much as the economy went down.
But, although that was the thought initially. And we also owned Walmart, and we owned McDonald's.
Right, the only stocks in the Dow, I think, as we've told our listeners in the past, that were actually doing okay during this period.
Yes, the thought was as the consumer got pinched a bit, you know, maybe they would trade down.
Now, aside from funds that do some short selling and other of these less straightforward maneuvers, you were the only fund to come out in positive territory. What's wrong with your industry?
Well, you know, most years there's some place that does well, and if you avoided the bad spots and you were in the good spots, there are people that would become positive. But this past year, there was just no place to hide. We were fortunate in that we made some big moves. We did use some cash throughout the year, which didn't go down when the market went down, and we were very active in our buying and selling of stocks, and that if we were in cash for a while, we also then got back into the market when it went back up. So We were fortunate to do that.
But it's so hard, and just speaking as an individual investor, to let that money sit in cash.
Sure.
I mean, how can you just leave it sitting there doing nothing?
Right.
You know it's not going to go up.
Right.
That really takes fortitude.
It did. It was very, you know, emotionally, it was a very difficult year because you were betting that everybody else out there was wrong. And, you know, you can't make too many bets like that in your life. Usually when that's the case, you're the one who's wrong, not everybody else.
Well, you must not be feeling very lonely anymore.
No.
Well, Tom, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, sure. Great. Thank you.
Tom Forrester joining us from Chicago. He manages the Forrester Value Fund, the only U.S. diversified mutual fund to have made money in 2008. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. And if it didn't cheer you up to hear that, Tom Forrester made money and you didn't, try this one on. Despite being the cruelest time of year, U.S. companies laid off more than 500,000 people in December. We learned that today. Unemployment is now at 7.2%. It's the worst in 16 years. And lots of us are reporting to our jobs now in January, knowing there are more cuts to come. We asked our listeners early this week about what their jobs feel like with layoffs in the recent past and looming over the future. Here are two of the many people who got back to us.
My name is Sarah Martin, and I work for an internet technology company.
My name is Chris Chase. I work for a company that publishes technical manuals.
And we did have a round of layoffs. I have been heartily assured by everybody that I'm fine, they love me, I'm great. But you still wonder, like, how much does anyone know?
It's been extremely busy in the past 2 or 3 months, mainly, I think, as a result of the fact that we have had huge layoffs before that. And so now any job that we get in, it's a smaller workforce that has to take care of it. At one point, we had about 15 illustrators, and we're down to 3 right now.
I keep taking on, like, special projects, even inventing special products, like, hey, here's something that I see that we could be doing better. How about I be in charge of that? Therefore, they'll have to keep me.
There's just so much to do that there's really no time to not work hard, I should say. Really focusing on the task at hand, putting up with a lot of stuff that normally you would complain about, and realizing that there's nothing else out there, so it's a good idea to do everything you possibly can to keep what I have right now.
I was kind of hoping for a promotion. Unfortunately, they had to put on a hiring freeze and a salary freeze where I work. And it feels a little bit like all the work that went into kind of developing my career has just been shot down. I spend a little bit more time kind of not taking it seriously, having a little bit longer lunch because I know that the above and beyond effort isn't going to get me anywhere, and I don't want to burn myself out and start making mistakes.
Sarah Martin from Minneapolis and Chris Chase from Jericho, Vermont. Thanks to everybody who got back to us. We're going to keep collecting stories on this topic, and you can share yours with us at the In the Loop page at minnesotapublicradio.org. You can also sign up for the Loop Network if you want to get call-outs for future stuff like this that we're working on. Music there, as usual, by The Smarts, online at thesmartsband.com. We wanted to talk a little bit more about what happens to us when we're working under a cloud of layoffs. The people who study this kind of thing and help companies deal with it are called organizational psychologists, and I've got one of them with me now, Tahara Probst, associate professor at Washington State University, Vancouver. Tahara, thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When that layoff axe is potentially hanging over your head, how do most people tend to respond in their work habits?
We tend to find that they're less satisfied with their jobs. They're less loyal to the organization. So one thing that you might actually find is that they start looking for other jobs. You know, this organization isn't treating me all that well. I'm going to start looking elsewhere. You also find that when individuals are threatened with layoffs, they have lower levels of creativity. So that can actually have unfortunate effects for the organization as well.
Well, and the message that you get from the boss, from management, is we need you all to pull together. You know, work harder. We need everything that you can do for us to help the company get through it.
Right.
That's not what happens.
In some cases, sure. I mean, the employees pull together. They want the organization to succeed. But on the other hand, people maybe get so caught up in how do I keep my job that they don't realize it's maybe some of the choices and decisions that they're making aren't necessarily the best for either themselves or the company. So they might, for example, in manufacturing settings, they might take safety shortcuts, you know, thinking, well, I can get more of the job done. I can produce more. But you actually find that the quality of the work that they're producing tends to go down, as well as their safety-related behaviors.
And that's some of the stuff that you yourself have studied, right?
Actually, I've done some laboratory research on this where we've actually brought individuals into the laboratory. We actually do find that you do see a productivity boost. You do see that increase, but it's really short-lived. It's not something that organizations can bank on, and I certainly wouldn't recommend that organizations thinking, how can I increase productivity? Let's just, you know, tighten the screws a bit.
Keep the axe over people's heads all the time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because the fact is that even though you might get that short-term productivity boost, when you look at the mere myriad of just really very negative, awful consequences as a result of job insecurity. You really don't want those to go hand in hand with maybe that short-term productivity boost.
I suppose a big part of how workers respond is how the company does the actual layoffs. Have you seen some pretty bad examples?
there are some doozies. But the worst example I ever heard of was an organization where the company CEO brought all the individuals, all the workers, into a large room. There was a line drawn down the center of the room, and they were separating employees into one side of the room or the other side of the room. And the CEO gets up and says, well, hard times are coming. We need to lay off people. Everybody that's on this side of the room, congratulations. You get to keep your job. Mm. Everybody on that side of the room, walk out this door, and you'll find all the outplacement assistants and HR managers that'll help you fill out your paperwork and get you on your way.
So it was convenient from sort of like a geographic perspective. You're closer to the door where the help is. Now we've got you part
exactly. way. Exactly. Exactly. And I'm sure that they went about it thinking that they were doing this in a good way, like it's very efficient. Do the exit interview, fill out the paperwork, get your outplacement assistance.
It's one-stop shopping.
One-stop shopping, exactly.
Oh,
and so I think they probably thought they were doing a good thing. And in fact, you can imagine how traumatized you would be if you're walking in this room wondering what's going on.
Certainly, a lot of the reaction would boil down to kind of individual personality, right? Some people would choose to buckle down. Other people would start slacking because, you know, who really cares anyway? I'm just going to get laid off. Do you see any broader patterns in terms of, by and large, what happens to people?
Oftentimes, the ones that are the hardest hit are actually the ones that organizations should do the most to try to protect and retain them. So some of the earliest research that I did on this topic looked at those employees who were really involved in their jobs, were really committed to the organization, loved their job, loved their work, everything that an organization wants. They're the exact ones, though, that are more affected by job insecurity in terms of physical health effects and psychological effects. And those are exactly the employees that the organization should want to keep.
Well, maybe if they just look at who's really nervous. You know, those are the people they want to keep around.
That's right. That's right.
Well, this is unfortunately relevant for a lot of people listening and will be for a while. It's been good to talk with you, Tahara. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Tahara Probst is an associate professor of organizational psychology at Washington State University, Vancouver. Layoffs are rampant around most of the country, but there are some job offers being extended. No joke, Joe the Plumber has been hired by a conservative website to do man-on-the-street reporting in the Middle East. And CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta, I'm sure you've heard of this, could become the nation's next Surgeon General. We speculated on our blog the other day about some other appointments along those lines. Kiefer Sutherland at the Secret Service, of course. Ryan Seacrest to head the NEA. Sam Waterston would make a great Solicitor General. A reader chimed in with some other nominations. Mulder and Scully at the FBI, duh. Susie Orman at Treasury. Jack LaLanne and his power juicer as the Secretary of Energy. And Maggie Gyllenhaal in a post titled simply, Secretary. Didn't see that movie? Okay, don't worry about it. Thanks to Alex Franzen for those extra nominations left on our blog, The Loophole. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is In the Loop. Now on to the big international news item of the week. Israeli planes continued bombing Gaza today, and rockets from the territory continued to fly in the other direction. The UN says it is too dangerous to get in with aid shipments. When news about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict flares up, so do accusations that U.S. media are biased on one side or the other. One place that catches plenty of flack is National Public Radio. The listener complaints come from both sides, and it has been that way for years. As of this morning, NPR's ombudsman tells me they've had 181 emails on the topic since mid-November, most coming the last 2 weeks. They're still sorting through them, so it is too early to say how they break down. NPR is certainly not alone in getting this kind of criticism, but it is a place I and so many of you depend on for our coverage of the conflict, so I thought we would spend a few minutes with this issue. I've got two of NPR's biggest critics on the phone with me now, Ali Abu Nima and Gilad Aini. Thanks both of you for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ali is a fellow at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., and he runs the online journal Electronic Intifada. Gilad is a senior research analyst with the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, which monitors coverage of Israel. I flipped a coin, and Gilad, I'm going to go to you first. You've been saying for years that NPR has a pro-Palestinian bias. What is your problem with the coverage?
Even though there is some good reporting, and oftentimes the facts are correct, NPR isn't presenting listeners with a complete, rounded, and nuanced picture of the conflict. We took a look at coverage over the course of a month back in 2000 during the beginning of the fighting, and we noticed a consistent 35% to 65% ratio of Israeli speakers and word count and time to Palestinian word count and time. As to why the media get it wrong. There's a lot of theories that different people have. I mean, possibly maybe it's an overly simplistic conception of the underdog and the belief that because the Palestinians have less sophisticated weapons, people feel less comfortable perhaps scrutinizing this perceived underdog. It may be human nature, as if you're watching a Rocky movie, to back who on the surface seems to be the underdog, even though the conflict is much more complex than that.
Ali, let's go to you, and I'll put the same question to you, basically. What do you think is at the root of the problems that you hear when you listen to NPR cover this conflict?
I think the bigger problem is a lack of context. If you do the math, the Palestinians have fired about 12 to 15 tons of explosives into Israel over a period of 8 years. That sounds like a lot. But here's a statistic that it's never contrasted with. On the very first day, December 27th, of Israel's attack on Gaza, Israel dropped 100 tons of bombs. And we're not talking about fertilizer bombs. We're talking about military-grade high explosives. On NPR, many journalists are afraid to state as facts anything that disturbs the notion that there is a balance and that equal sides are fighting.
Do you think the impulse for balance has any place in the coverage of this conflict?
Well, I think we should hear about the experiences of Israelis and Palestinians, but that points to another problem. Israelis present themselves and look like, quote-unquote, us, middle-class Western people who we can identify with. Palestinians, from our perspective, look foreign. They're easily demonized. Journalists have a responsibility to do extra work to humanize and relate the experience of those who appear to be very foreign or other to us.
So you both find on each side, you know, facts that are missing, things that are out of proportion. There's a saying in journalism that if both sides are mad at you, you must be doing something right. Agree? Either of you can take that.
I absolutely disagree. It's a clever saying, but I don't think it's true, and I can only guess that Mr. Abuniba might agree with me on this point. It's very easy to get both sides to speak, but it eventually becomes meaningless what both sides are saying, and what becomes, you know, essential is the actual reporting and the amount of time given to speakers from each side and the amount of time devoted to the concerns of each side and what's being said and what's not being said.
Ali, is it possible to have both sides in this conflict be happy with us as journalists?
I don't know, but I don't think that the role of journalists is to make both sides happy, and I think that that's often the mistake NPR makes. I think the role of journalists is to investigate and to help guide listeners to say, well, this person's claims are more credible than that person's claims, and here are the reasons why.
I want to ask you both, Gilad first, and then Ali, I'll give you the last word. If you could, in, say, a minute or less, a few concrete steps that you would recommend for National Public Radio to improve their reporting from the conflict in your eyes?
I think they need to go in more depth about the conflict in the whole. I think they need to devote features and significant time to the issue of Hamas and its anti-Semitic charter and its goals of eliminating Israel. I think they need to try harder at following media ethics. I think they need a truly independent ombudsman and truly independent outside eyes to kind of help shuttle them to the kind of objective and fair journalism, because that's key.
And Ali, to you, what are a few concrete changes that you'd like to see made that might make things better as far as you're concerned?
What I would suggest is that NPR should put a bureau or more than one bureau inside a Palestinian community in the Gaza Strip. I've heard the excuse before that it's too dangerous, but they've had bureaus in Iraq when it's been much, much, much more dangerous, in Afghanistan, and I think there's no excuse on this issue that concerns so many people not to have bureaus in Palestinian communities.
Interestingly, I actually agree with the suggestion that NPR and other media outlets have a bureau in Gaza, probably for a different reason, is because I think if there are bureaus in Gaza, then it makes it more likely that journalists will be less reliant on Palestinian stringers who live in Gaza and might be more susceptible to intimidation by Hamas.
Wait a minute, Gilad, because what you seem to be saying to people is that Palestinians are inherently untrustworthy.
All right, I'm going to tell you what. Inasmuch as we have at least a tentative agreement on one particular point, I think it's nice to end there. I want to thank you both for joining us for this somewhat challenging conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ali Abunima publishes the Electronic Intifada online journal at electronicintifada.net. Gilad Aini is a senior research analyst with the Committee for Accuracy in Middle Eastern Reporting in America, camera.org. What you just heard is part of a much longer conversation I had with these guys. If you want to hear the whole thing, it's on the In the Loop page at minnesotapublicradio.org. NPR reported earlier this week on the difficulty of reporting from Gaza. Despite an Israeli Supreme Court ruling, the Israeli military is denying entry to foreign reporters, something NPR is protesting. NPR says for now, a network of stringers and freelance reporters helps provide news from inside the territory. NPR's ombudsman says she's looking into concerns about the coverage, and she should have a new column on that topic posted sometime next week. We will link you there from our website, or just find the ombudsman's page at npr.org. In her email to me this morning, she said listener complaints are often pegged to something they heard in one or two stories, which is frustrating because NPR is producing so much material on the conflict at this point. At the moment, there are 5 reporters on the story full time, plus a photographer, stringers, and interpreters. You are listening to In the Loop. I am Jeff Horwich. And before we wrap up here, a little detour into technology news, if I might. This week, Apple co-founder Steve Jobs put out kind of a cryptic statement explaining why he's been looking so gaunt lately, and perhaps why he was skipping the Macworld conference this week in San Francisco. Something vague about a hormone problem, maybe related to his treatment for pancreatic cancer 4 years ago. Now, I'm not exactly one of them, but you have to concede that hordes of people love Apple. And they worship Steve Jobs. His health has become a genuine issue of public concern, and hence a worthy topic for our standard end-of-the-show musical treatment.
When you walked out looking so pale and thin, like an iPod shuffle the cat dragged in, well, it called up all of my darkest fears. I pressed pause, took the earbuds out of my ears. Losing you, I can't imagine anything worse. Oh, you're the guiding light of my fanboy universe. You changed my life and I love you so. Oh, Steve, no, Steve, don't go. I guess the world today would be a very different place without your mouse-driven graphical desktop interface. A working no belt, a turtleneck and blue jeans, gracing all the covers of the business magazines. If we lost you, Steve, even just to retirement, the world would be a less exciting user environment. I'm covered in white from my head to my toe. Oh, Steve, no, Steve, don't go. We know you can be serious, impetuous, imperious. You think an awful lot of yourself, but there's no succession plan. Hey, let's face it, you're the man. There's an industry devoted just to following your health. You taught the tech world one immutable rule. People pay out the nose when they think stuff is cool. You're the king of buzz and you're the king of cute. Control Apple, eject Steve, you gotta reboot. Well, now you say it's some kind of hormonal imbalance. That should be no match for your formidable talents. Get some rest, eat healthy. Take it slow, oh Steve, no Steve, don't go. This song was recorded on a Mac, don't you know? Oh Steve, no Steve, don't go.
In the Loop is produced by Sandin Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith. Special help this week from Anna Wagle. We're easy to find on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and of course, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. I am Jeff Horwich. See you next week.